listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. You really need to know this. In the pantheon of American politics, Edward Snowden is the little boy who said that the emperor has no clothes. Right? He has forced us to acknowledge and have a conversation about something we should have known all along. And you know, many of us in some ways did or suspected that ever since Congress approved the Patriot Act in the first year of the Bush-Cheney administration, our national security and intelligence apparatus has become increasingly large and dangerously invasive. We first caught wind of the brave new world of the surveillance state in 2006 when the New York Times revealed the Bush administration's NSA-operated warrantless wiretapping program. Right? Hey, remember when Senator Obama promised an end to what he called the failed policies of my predecessor, of George W. Bush during his first presidential campaign? You know, many of us thought what that meant is that he was going to rein in this whole giant security machine, whatever. I mean, he did do some very, very positive. Yeah, he stopped the torture. Although it hasn't been legislatively stopped, it could be restarted if a new president were to come in and just sign a different executive order. You can't lay that at Obama's feet. I mean, this is we've got a problem with Congress right now. But, you know, he's done some good. He stopped using the war on terror as a phrase. He gave a very good speech on national security the other day and has changed some of our policies. But by and large, this giant national security institution hasn't changed. The surveillance state has continued to grow, in fact, under the Obama administration. Congress passed and the president signed a renewed Patriot Act in 2011. And in December of 2012, reauthorized an amended version of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that essentially legalized Bush's illegal wiretapping operations. And now we know that the Obama administration and the NSA have used these laws to justify invasive spying programs in ways that even hardcore neocons like Jim Sensenbrenner, Republican right-winger extraordinaire and author, or a author, one of the authors of the original Patriot Act, find disturbing. Now, some politicians, like Oregon Senator Ron Wyden back in 2011, have been for some time trying to warn us about this alarming and top-secret trend. Here's Ron Wyden.
When the American people find out how their government has secretly interpreted the Patriot Act, they are going to be stunned, and they are going to be angry.
That was 2 years ago. And some former intelligence agency workers, like whistleblower Thomas Drake, have gone so far as to expose certain parts of the NSA's operations. For that, Drake is now in jail. But so far, all of these warnings have fallen on deaf ears, which is apparently why Edward Snowden stepped forward to show once and for all how massive and powerful and corporatized and privatized this so-called national security industry has grown under the past two administrations. Snowden was interviewed this morning in the South China Sea paper. It was one of the Hong Kong newspapers. And he said that he was neither traitor nor hero. I'm an American. This was the quote from Snowden. I would say the guy is a hero. You know, I would definitely say the guy is a hero. And in fact, we need more heroes like him. And it goes beyond that. I mean, here's an even bigger problem. And that is that when people like Snowden work for the CIA or the NSA, there are actually at law whistleblower protections. They're modest, but they're there. That would cover them. So if they're government employees and they're blowing the whistle And they do it, you know, the, quote, appropriate way. There is some protection for them. Now, those protections need to be radically expanded and amplified, along with the any press that might participate with a whistleblower being empowered as well. But here's the giant loophole. While there are even at-law whistleblower protections for some people in some industries, the intelligence industry is specifically carved out from the whistleblower protection laws. So whistleblowers in the intelligence industry, they got nothing. This is why Snowden went to Hong Kong. I mean, if he actually is a whistleblower, and I believe he is, and he was still working for the CIA or the NSA, arguably have some protections here in the United States. But working for a private contractor, and now there's over 1,000 of these giant contractors with billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in contracts to spy on us and others. Working for these private corporations, totally unaccountable. There's something fundamentally wrong about this. We need to, you know, you can't have a functional democracy. You can't have a functioning republic. Whatever you want to call this country, a constitutionally limited democratic republic, a constitutional monarchy with the Supreme Court in charge, whatever. You can't have a nation that functions without some level of transparency. Without the ability of people who are inside the machine to speak to us outside the machine and say, hey, this part of the machine is rotten, it's corrupt, it's dangerous, it's doing things it shouldn't be doing, it's breaking the law, it's violating the Constitution, whatever it may be. We can't have a functioning republic if we don't have that. And so I find myself in the odd company of Glenn Beck and Bernie Sanders in calling Edward Snowden a hero. I don't think Bernie's odd company, but I just think it's interesting that that across the spectrum there are people who are acknowledging. I mean, of course you've got the people who are going to run to a camera or a microphone and go, death penalty, torture, treason, traitor, the knee jerk nationalists, I would call them. But thoughtful people on both sides of the aisle, from Rand Paul to Bernie Sanders, thoughtful commentators, even hard right conservative commentators like Beck, are saying this guy's a hero, and we need to make sure. Now, I'm not quoting Glenn Beck here. This is me, or Bernie Sanders, or anybody else. This is what I have to say about it. We not only have to honor what Snowden has done, but we need to make it legal. You know, we need to build in these protections. He has not revealed state secrets. He hasn't told us what he knows. He has simply told us what it is, you know, how big it is, which is what Ron Wyden was trying to say on the floor of the Senate 2 years ago. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The national security state needs to be reined in, and most importantly, the industry itself needs to be put out of business. Snowden a hero or a goat in the biblical sense? Jesus was separating the sheep from the goats, and the goats were the ones who went off to hell. And I shouldn't have to explain this anyway. Is he a hero or a traitor? And where do we go with this? What do we do with this? I continue to think that the biggest challenge that we are facing right now is not so much the Patriot Act, is not so much the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the FISA courts that it produced. I think these are bad pieces of legislation. But I continue to believe that the biggest problem that we're facing right now is the Reaganomics doctrine that government functions should be outsourced to private for-profit corporations. And that among those government functions are things that we really, really do need to be holding close to our vest. We need, you know, our prison industry. If we're gonna use the power of the state to imprison people, it should be to rehabilitate them or to protect society from them, not so somebody can make a dollar off it. Our military. If we're gonna have a large, strong, capable military, it should be to protect the United States and our strategic interests around the world. It should not be so that Dick Cheney's old company, Halliburton, which was just inches away from bankruptcy when he was selected by the Supreme Court to be vice president of the United States in 2000, which Joe Biden pointed out today. Let me digress for just a moment. Joe Biden, or it was in today's news, perhaps it was last night that he said it, but Joe Biden came out and said Al Gore was actually elected president. And he did the right thing for the Republic when we had this bad decision by the Supreme Court and you know, didn't step into office. Now, you can argue whether Al Gore saying, okay, I'm going to go along with the Supreme Court is the right thing or not. I'm guessing had he not done that, I mean, he would have been facing, you know, a court that might have even ordered his imprisonment. I mean, who knows? This would have been a genuine constitutional crisis of the type that Americans thought was going to happen in 1800, in the election of 1800. But, you know, all that said, and I find it just fascinating, you know, that the Vice President of the United States right now, Joe Biden, comes out and says, yeah, Al Gore is actually elected president of the United States. Finally, somebody's telling the truth about it. But anyhow, all that aside, the big problem that I see is this Reaganomics doctrine that we should be handing this stuff off to private for-profit corporations, a doctrine that has been supported by the Supreme Court. So now you have private for-profit corporations that are profiting off the national security state, and thus have an incentive to lobby for more and more snooping, more and more spying, more and more big contracts, more and more giant computers, more and more and more big data centers, more and more Big Brother. They've become the tail that's wagging the dog of government. Because the Supreme Court legalized it, And Reagan turned it into a theology. In the next hour, Richard Viguerie is going to drop by, the uber conservative, and we're going to talk about prison reform. And you know that these guys are still pitching, hey, private prisons are the answer to everything. No, and private defense contractors are not the answer. Spying contractors are not the answer to everything. In fact, private spying contractors are the problem. We should not be outsourcing. There are just some things you don't outsource. We should not be outsourcing legislation. Consider this. Several times a year, there's this group called the American Legislative Exchange Council that gets together with virtually entirely Republican state legislators. There are a few Democrats who are members, but it's almost entirely Republicans. They get together at various places around the country, and one-to-one, legislator to lobbyist, corporations and Republican legislators sit in the room together and come up with what they call model legislation. They write legislation to take back and introduce into the states. And in most cases, it's not actually even written at these ALEC meetings. It's written by the corporations long before their lobbyists show up at the ALEC meetings. They bring it to the ALEC meetings, lay it out for the Republican lawmakers, inspection and approval, and maybe a few tweaks here and there. And then the Republicans take it back to their states and introduce it as law. And we've seen this in state after state after state with law after, after law after law, from things like the Stand Your Ground laws to the voter suppression laws to laws making it harder to prosecute corporations for malfeasance laws, you know, so-called tort reform laws. I mean, it just goes on. So we've even outsourced legislation legally by Supreme Court doctrine. The Supreme Court says, yeah, this is just fine. You can't pass a law against this. It's free speech. These corporations are people, and their money is speech. And so now we have this national security state, which has conservatives and libertarians a little concerned, many of them a lot concerned, and liberals and progressives a lot concerned. But I think even worse, we have a national security industry that is self-perpetuating and doing everything it can to grow itself like a cancer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And nobody is talking about that industry. And that industry, in my mind, is the big danger. In the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Ooh. My left arm is slowly getting better. Step by step, row by row, as they say. Junior in Adrian, Minnesota. Hey, Junior, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. It's always an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
Before I get to my comments on the NSA and Eric Snowden, I remember your words reverberating around in my head saying how the founding fathers of this country knew when they signed the document of the Declaration of Independence, knew they were signing their death warrant.
Yeah, they were.
Democracy doesn't come without risk.
Yeah.
You know, democracy does not come without risk. Yeah. And you mentioned the national security state as if it was some sort of abstract concept. Well, since the privatization of this apparatus, we have close to something like 700,000-800,000 people in this country that have top secret security clearance. We're literally talking about giving, as a nation, top secret security clearance to a population the size of South Dakota.
Yeah, to 0.3% of the population of our entire country.
Literally an entire state.
Yeah.
And when you put that many links in a chain, you're going to wind up with someone like Eric Snowden that's going to blow the whistle. Especially when you're, you know, especially considering the fact that you're privatizing everything.
Well, in fact, let me add to that. How can a government say this is incredibly sensitive stuff? This is so important. These secrets are so incredibly vital to national security. We're going to, you know, wrap all kinds of laws and things around them. Oh, and by the way, we're going to hand them off to a private contractor who can, you know, who can hire somebody with a GED to go in and listen in on the president's conversations with his wife.
Exactly.
It's like, really?
And you wind up with people who, regardless of whether or not their conscience is driving them or whether that they have an axe to grind, they're going to be driven by some force to, you know, expose these secrets, regardless of whether or not it's in our own national best interest or whether it's in their own personal best interest.
Yeah, well, that may or may not be the case, but what it says to me is that if we've given almost 1 million people top secret clearance, then and access to, you know, pieces of our national security apparatus, perhaps we're not taking this as seriously as we should. You know, instead, it's just become a giant money pot, and these corporations are just growing exponentially, I mean literally exponentially, and the budget, I mean the NSA budget is a black box. Nobody has any idea how much money is allocated to the NSA except the people on the intelligence committees in Congress, and they're not saying, they can't say. And then, you know, that money then goes to these, you know, how much of that is going to the contractors? What percentage of the budget? We don't know. We should know these things. We should at least know those things. Junior, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Mike in Atlanta. Hey, Mike, you disagree with me?
I sure do. I don't think this man's any kind of a hero. I think he's a zero. They were reporting today that he was on China television telling China how we were monitoring them.
You think China didn't know that?
Do you find it ironic that he says he doesn't want to live in a society where the government monitors the people, then he moves to China?
No, it's not what he said. A, that's not what he said, and B, he didn't move to China.
Where is he?
Well, he's in Hong Kong right now, which is actually operates under different rules than the mainland of China and has a separate court system than the mainland of China. It is under the control of China the way it used to be under the control of Great Britain, but it is an independent protectorate. Saying somebody who moves to Puerto Rico has moved to the United States. Well, sort of not. They've got their own rules.
Okay. Well, I think we're splitting hairs here, but I'll give that to you. But anyway, you know, Glenn Beck and is calling this guy a hero. But I wonder what would happen if we had another attack on this, you know, on our soil, where over 3,000 Americans were killed. Who would be the first one complaining that we're not being protected?
Telling us that our intelligence service is doing a lousy job, telling us that our intelligence service is spying on us rather than on the bad guys, telling us that this industry has grown like a cancer without giving out details that could be used to compromise national security is, I think, a heroic thing. I think that what this guy did needed to be done. He did what Ron Wyden was begging somebody to do.
Well, I agree with you that I don't think it should be in the hands of private corporations. I agree with you 100% on that.
Okay.
My whole thing is that, you know, I never heard Glenn Beck complain when George Bush was president and they passed the Patriot Act. Never heard him say one thing. When President Obama got into office, that's when he started complaining. Big brother's out to get
you. I don't listen to Glenn Beck regularly, so I have no idea if that's the case or not. And in fact, I don't want to make this about Glenn Beck. Really what this is about is, in my opinion, is this really two issues. Number one, whistleblowers. You know, what's the status of whistleblowers, and why is it that whistleblowers who work for private security contractors have no legal protections whatsoever? And why is it that whistleblowers who work for the government have minimal security protection or legal protection? You would think, you know, particularly Republicans who say that, you know, government is a problem, it's not the solution, that they would want whistleblowers to be able to point out when government does things wrong. But no, not so much. They don't so much go along with that. And number two, should these be privatized? And it sounds to me like, you know, we're achieving a consensus about that. Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will.
Hey, Tom. How are you? I think the thing with Obama and his apparent change in attitude towards, you know, the surveillance stuff, which completely contradicts what he said he thought 5 years ago, I think that points out again once, you know, the obvious truth that executives, but really any politician of any power, but mainly at the executive level, they never ever give back the power that they've been granted by prior administrations.
Yes.
Which is they never ever surrender it. Which is why it's obviously so important when there's a push to do things that everybody knows, or most people know, I should say, are dangerous or unconstitutional, why they have to be stopped dead in their tracks before they get too far. This is another example of that. It's too late. Well, it's already now. We have this cancer in our society.
Yeah.
That's going to be damn near impossible getting rid of because it's been put in there illegally originally. And now Obama has this new power, and he simply doesn't want to surrender it. I mean, he may have reasons that could perhaps be noble, although I question that, frankly.
Well, I think actually the last caller, you know, pointed it out. Here's the conundrum that President Obama finds himself in. Let's assume for a moment that he might even totally agree with everything that I've said, and that there should be no privatization of national security. that we need to dial it back, that we need to get this stuff under control. I mean, that's sort of the direction he was going in the speech that he gave a month or so ago on national security. If he were to take the steps that I'm suggesting and just say, okay, that's it, no more of these contracts. We're going to do this stuff with government employees, government workers, 40 years in retirement and a pension and you're out, the G8s to G6, whatever they are, and just change things, any kind of change at all. And there was another 9/11. And there may well be. I mean, we're still PO-ing people around the world. The first thing that would come out of the mouth of the John McCains of the world and the right-wing talk show hosts, the whole right-wing echo chamber, which is huge, would be Obama caused this to happen. You know, if a Democrat had been in the White House on 9/11, we would not be discussing 9/11 the way that we do now. We would be discussing it as the intelligence failure of, had it been President Gore and on 9/11. From that day to this, it would be President Gore's failure, President Gore's intelligence failure, President Gore's failure to protect our country. It would be all about that. But instead, because a Republican was in office, the media just, went along and sucked up and the right wing spin machine did its spin. And there just really isn't that analog on the Democratic and side and on the left, unfortunately. So Obama finds himself in a position where if he makes those changes, if he is inclined to, and I honestly don't know what's in his heart, I don't know if he's inclined to or not, but if he makes those changes and anything happens, even if it has nothing to do with those changes whatsoever, he'll be blamed for it.
Right. Yeah, I do think that I agree with you. You're right. Of course, what you're saying, your analysis is right. I think that that's why it takes an incredibly, incredibly special kind of person to not be vulnerable to that kind of thing. Someone who really has such an incredibly strong sense of morality and ethics that they, even in their face of their own self, political or destruction, that they would basically still do the quote-unquote right thing. I think Bowdoin is like that, frankly, by the way. I think he is a hero. This is someone who basically surrendered his life.
Ed Snowden.
Yes, right. So. That guy, if that's not a hero, I don't know who is. He is stunning. He's an that guy is amazing. He really is a hero.
Yeah. Did you read the blog that his girlfriend kept? They had it on TPM this morning.
No.
And the very last paragraph she wrote the day after he identified himself and he had left. They had been living together for 8 years, apparently. And she's like, I'm typing through a tear-stained keyboard. It was so poignant. But, yeah, I think he's a hero, too. Will, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio here in Blakeslee, Pennsylvania. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We will be right back with more of your thoughts, my thoughts, and the news of the day.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is interesting. Benedict noting in the chat room that the Supreme Court has actually struck down the law that authorized prison. To dig into that. 10 minutes before the hour on the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Or the Carlyle Group, for that matter? And we dare to answer, no, I don't think so, not a chance. Matt in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Matt.
Hi, how you doing? I think Snowden is a hero. He's a hero of mine. I'm a fan of Orwell and studying aspects of privacy. I feel that Americans who say, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, go ahead, look through my information, I don't care, that's kind of being intellectually dishonest, because one of the aspects of being a prisoner in prison is that you don't have privacy.
Right.
So, and when you're talking about privatization, I love your show. It really stimulates my thinking. You can't make money off privacy if it's widely available. So what you do is you make privacy scarce. And if you've ever noticed how the wealthy are obsessed with their privacy. So I think you're touching on these subjects that we need to talk about. So
yeah.
I wanted to ask you.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, couldn't a different, well, there is no patriotism in business. I think that's kind of the theme that you talk about on your show off and on, especially with this idea about privatizing our security. There's
well, and in fact, by law, the first order, the first obligation of a business is to generate profit, not to work for the benefit of the nation.
Right. So could not, I'd like to ask you your thoughts on this. Couldn't another company in the future purchase Booz Allen Hamilton, the company in charge of sucking up all of our data? Couldn't another foreign company or a portion of that, or a company owned by the Chinese military or the Saudi, couldn't they in the future buy that company and then with that route then own all of the data that the United States government hired them to collect?
It's remotely possible. I'm pretty sure that built into the contracts with these contractors is that there can't be foreign ownership or there can't be large amounts of foreign ownership. But if the reports are true, if Robert Perry's report is true, that the Carlyle Group owns Booz Allen Hamilton, and then I'd like to know who owns the Carlyle Group. Because my recollection back when George Herbert Walker Bush was brought into the Carlyle Group after he left the presidency was that some of its investors included, Saudi sheikhs. And so it may be that foreign companies already own part of our intelligence. So, certainly it's conceivable, and it's another good and strong reason. And Matt, thank you for pointing it out, to say privatization is nuts for national security. It should not be happening. Thank you, Matt. William in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, William, you disagree with me.
I agree with you most of the time, Tom, on everything, okay, but this one here is, you got me. I was in this game for 20-some years. I go back as far back as when we was listening to people on using Morse code, so you know how long that was.
Sure.
And so, but this guy's not a hero. We took an oath, just like I did. I took an oath. I got my security clearance, and I stuck to it. Now, when my politics start changing.
William? We have lost William. William, I'm sorry. If you can hear me, I can't hear you any longer. I think that your phone is croaked. What I would say is that Snowden was not working for the government. He was working for a private contractor. And that he didn't release classified information to the best of my knowledge. He simply pointed out how big this program. Now, you could argue that that's classified, but it seems to me that what he was doing was whistleblower, not leaker. And if he was leaking things, then you could say, okay, he violated his oath. But you take an oath to work for a corporation, for a private for-profit corporation? I don't think so. I mean, it just doesn't sound right to me. It doesn't make sense to me. And again, it's another reason why I think we need to get these private for-profit corporations out of the business. Rick in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Rick, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, great. For a minute there, I thought we'd lost our phone system again. So,
oh yeah,
what's
I was
up?
I was calling with just that very topic, Tom. That which oath takes precedent? With Brad Manning, or in this case as well.
Yeah, is it the oath to uphold the Constitution, or is it the oath to do what your boss tells you, basically?
Exactly. And on one side they tell you you're supposed to speak up.
Yeah.
It's doublethink.
Yeah, it is. And we honor those people who spoke up and signed the Declaration of Independence, for example, the original speak up, or engaged in the Boston Tea Party, the pre-original speak up. And
yeah, they're in capital letters in the history books.
Yeah. Yeah. And throughout history, the people who have stood up and pointed out social wrongs, whether it was Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or whether it was Martin Luther King, or whether it was, the lists go on and on.
It was, nobody had an easy ride sometimes.
Yeah, people very often paid terrible prices, including some of the signers of the Declaration, for speaking up. But it's a good point, Rick. Thank you. What's our time? How much time do we have? Oh, I got time for another call. Judy, listening in Brighton, Colorado on AM 760. We have a minute, Judy.
Yes, Snowden's a hero. I think our politicians are not heroes. This has been going on for such a long time, I'm not surprised about any of this. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover had huge files on everybody and bribed all of the presidents and all the politicians all the time.
Right.
Be interesting to see where those files are. And I'm not sure that all of this information that they're gathering is just used for national security. How do we know this? We don't know. And I'd like to know where the people are that are so for the Second Amendment and gun rights. Where are they on the Fourth Amendment? How come they're not screaming out about this?
Well, there's no money to be made on the Fourth Amendment, you know, on protecting privacy. Or on promoting privacy, rather. I mean, there's money to be made in violating privacy, in violating the Fourth Amendment. But there is money to be made with, you know, by promoting the Second Amendment. I mean, the gun manufacturers, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. That's why they can afford to pay Wayne Little Pierre, you know, $2 million a year. So, Judy, excellent point. Thank you for calling. Thanks for listening to AM760 in Denver. It's coming up on the top of the hour. Richard Viguerie is going to be with us. Yes, that Richard Viguerie, the world-famous conservative, right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We've been talking about the power, the danger of when the power of the state, the power to walk into your home with a gun, the power to imprison you, is handed over to private for-profit corporations, in this case, Booz Allen Hamilton and the Carlyle Group that owns them, apparently. But what about that power itself? I mean, just in its raw form, prison. Richard A. Viguerie is with us. He's the chairman of conservativehq.com, the author of the book Conservatives Betrayed, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. And, Richard, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
It's been some years, it seems. Yes. You and a group of friends of yours are working on, in fact, you wrote a piece called Conservative Case for Prison Reform. Lay this out for us.
Well, it's an issue that, Tom, I've been concerned about for a long time, and I started, quite frankly, in the mid-1970s when I wrote about it and took a very strong position in opposition to the death penalty. And when some national liberals learned about it, they reached out to me, and I guess for the last 10 years or so, some high-profile liberals and conservatives have been meeting and discussing how we can advance this cause of doing away with the death penalty. And I've always kind of joined the two together, reform of the criminal justice system, because as horrendous as it is, particularly when mistakes are made, it still affects a relatively small number of people, but the millions and millions of people that are abused by this failed government program, criminal justice system at the federal, state, local
level. And in some populations, in the African-American population, for example, in the United States, it affects a significant percentage of the population.
Exactly. And it doesn't work for anybody. It doesn't work for the victims. It doesn't work for innocent people who could become victims of crime. It doesn't work for the taxpayers. It doesn't work for the prisoners themselves. And I know, a number of people in prison or who have been in prison, and I'm regularly in touch with them. And, fortunately, they've come out and walked a straight line, but we all know the recidivism rate is just out of control, and it's just not working.
Yeah. So what are your suggestions?
Well, what I say to my conservative friends, and I've gotten this op-ed piece that you were referring to, Tom, appeared in the New York Times on Monday, and I've gotten an enormous response from high-profile liberals and conservatives. My friend of 40 years, Morris D., Southern Poverty Law Center, called me Monday and was very excited about the article. And he just happened to have on the editorial page that same day in New York Times an editorial about a lawsuit that they had won forcing changes in the Mississippi criminal justice mm-hmm. system. And it's just it's an issue that for conservatives, we have to get out front and lead. Unfortunately, liberals, this is not a natural issue for them to lead on. Politically, most of them probably are very afraid of being labeled by conservatives, soft on criminals, as they have in the past. And so it's just like only the anti-communist Nixon could go to China. I think conservatives, you know, are the ones that have to lead on this, and will be quickly joined by a lot of liberals, I think. But
yeah, well, in that regard, and you point this out, you say these three principles, public safety, compassion, and controlling government spending, are at the core of conservative philosophy. You know, we could debate the compassion part, although actually I don't even think that we should debate that. I don't disagree with you on those things.
No,
but,
I think we're all
here's the big problem that I'm wondering how you're going to deal with. You correctly point out we have 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prisoners. We have more prisoners both on a per capita and actual basis than any other country in the world. And there's some pretty nasty countries out there. And there's and we're not the biggest country. We're 300 million people. India's got a billion. China's got over a billion. And that, you know, prison is costing a fortune. You know, $9 billion and $50 billion a year now, up from $9 billion in 85. You pointed out second fastest growing area of state budgets.
Yeah. Yep.
So how do we do this in the face of privatized prisons that have, in the face of prison having become an industry as a consequence in large part of what was presented as conservative philosophy by the Reagan administration and others associated with it, that we should privatize the government function of prisons. And now you have a prison industry that is lobbying for longer sentences, three strikes, you're out laws, more severe punishments there, that you have a private prison industry that is lobbying not to end Nixon's drug war. Now, whether you are in favor of Nixon's drug war or not, what the hell is the prison industry doing lobbying about the drug war? How do you do, you know, it seems to me like this is an industry that should not exist. And I'm just curious your take on the privatization of prisons and how you think you can be successful in reforming our prison system when you're up against multi-billion dollar corporations.
Well, everything you said, you know, is a problem, and I agree with it. The solution, I don't know, Tom, but I know that we're moving in the right direction. I am talking at different times to Senator Rand Paul, to former Senator Jim DeMint.
But Rand Paul wants to privatize all the prisons.
Well, that may be so, but he still is very concerned and shares the concerns, I think, pretty much that you and I talked about right now. George Will has written about it recently. There's a growing concern among, I guess, every conservative that I talk to at the national level. We've got to make changes here, and we can argue over whether prisons should be built by the government or, you know, private industry. That's something we can.
Well, I'm not talking about build. I'm talking about own.
We agree. We need fewer prisons
and run.
We need fewer prisoners.
But if okay, we can agree on that. But I don't see how we're going to get there as long as there is a profit motive in having more prisoners.
Well, there's a profit motive in a lot of things that we can, you know, say we need to, you know, reduce the amount of expenditure in behalf of.
For example.
Anything. I mean,
Seems like we're talking core government functions here.
Yeah, I understand. But this is exciting, Tom. Let's focus on the progress here. We've got the left and the right unanimously coming together and saying we've got a broken criminal justice system, and let's all come together and start talking about this.
I'm agreeing with you on all of that, except for that one piece, because I think that one of the most broken parts of our criminal justice system, and one of the reasons why it has been deteriorating, is the privatization of prisons and the growth of the prison industry. 2 years ago, the fastest growing industry in the United States was the private prison business.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I agree.
That should not be. That should. I mean, it can't. It seems to me like Barry Goldwater, and I went door to door for Barry Goldwater in 1964. I was 13 years old, but I did it with my dad. That Barry Goldwater would never in his wildest dreams say we should be handing off core government functions like policing and the consequence of policing, prisons and rehabilitation, to private corporations. That's not a conservative position. That's a corporatist position.
So that's fine. Let's sit down with the Republicans, the Democrats, conservatives, and liberals and begin to talk about this.
Okay.
It was inconceivable we could do this 5-10 years ago.
Okay.
We're at a point now. This is historic. Let's don't miss this opportunity. Everybody's on board. We in agreement. We need to make changes. Let's do it.
Yeah, but do you want to? Do you think we should have privatized prisons?
I don't know, Tom. I don't want to, you know, say yay or nay here. You know, I just don't think that's the core issue. I think, you know, the fact that liberals have been afraid to lead on this issue, conservatives haven't led. Now we're all in agreement. We need to sit down and talk about it. There's so many low-hanging fruits out there.
Yeah.
37 states have on the books right now a law that a prison giving childbirth must be shackled. I mean, there's 100 examples like that we can agree on. Let's start there.
Okay. We will start there. Richard A. Viguerie, the website conservativehq.com, the author of Conservatives Betrayed. Thank you, Richard, for being with us again.
Pleasure, Tom.
Good talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it was interesting. Nixon did go to China. Conservatives reforming prisons? Maybe. Well, that's pretty amazing. I was just looking at Richard Viguerie's the Wikipedia page on him. He's 79 years old. Wow. A guy's been around the conservative movement for a long time. He's one of the real shakers and movers with the moral majority back in the day. So how do we reform our prisons? And is it possible that conservatives can do this, or at least could take the lead on? I wish they would. I really wish they would. Because, you know, Richard Viguerie is right. Our prison system is broken. He says the solution lies not only inside prisons, but also with more effective community supervision systems using new technologies, drug tests, and counseling programs. Well, maybe these are the opportunities to make some money. We should also require ex-convicts to either hold a job or perform community service. There's lots of community service opportunities out there. But, you know, one of the problems that, but on the other hand, that's like one of those throwaway lines. Consider about half of the people in our prison system right now are mentally ill or drug addicted, which is, you could argue, a form of mental illness. And really, they don't need a job. They don't need community service. They need treatment. And then when their addiction or their mental illness is under control, we can talk about a job or community service. But let's not just pretend that everybody who's in jail is like, you know, the person who works, you know, at the desk or cubicle or building next door to you, or the clerk at the local store. Community-based program. Using free market and Christian principles, conservatives have an opportunity to put their beliefs into practice. We'll see. Color me skeptical, but hopeful. Okay? I'll just... skeptical, but hopeful. Patricia in Ettrick, Wisconsin. Hey, Patricia, you wanted to talk about privatizing prisons?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I know you're great, but you're going to get better.
Thank you. I'm working.
I thought that Mr. Viguerie had very little to say that we don't already know. I used to work for a halfway house for people coming out of prison, and of course it was a private corporate-owned facility, and their main goal was to keep their beds full.
Right.
And most people in prison, it's just in these corporate prisons, there shouldn't be such a thing as a corporate prison. Most of them are there because of drug charges that don't amount to a hill of beans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a waste of our taxpayer money.
Right.
So,
and if there are going to be any private halfway houses, for example, why not just simply require them to be not-for-profit organizations?
Well, of course they won't make any money that way.
I know, that's my point. But but then good people who want to, you know, who is somebody in the private sector who's not a government employee who feels a calling to work with prisoners or ex-prisoners or has experience in that area or was a prisoner themselves or whatever and who would like to start a halfway house can create a nonprofit organization to do, you know, to do that in a way that, that you know, doesn't require, you know, government appropriation. You know, it seems like a reasonable thing.
Well, I could tell you about as far as being nonprofit goes,
mm-hmm.
there are ways of being profitable, but it says nonprofit.
Well, yeah, it's the old pay the CEO $700,000 a year like the Red Cross did with
right.
Elizabeth Dole.
That's what they do. And I mean, so why wouldn't a corporate prison want to start a corporate halfway house?
Yeah.
And then when they fail in the corporate halfway house, send them back to the corporate prison
right.
and make even more money.
Right. And yeah, okay. And this is where I'm completely with you, Patricia. Absolutely and totally. Thanks a lot for the call. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was wondering, in the same way that we at one time, growing up in the 60s and 70s, I recall we had prohibited or strongly discouraged our law enforcement officers from openly participating in politics and politicking and going door to door for a certain candidate or political party. What's to stop us from prohibiting the private prison industry from lobbying? Can't we not just prohibit them from doing that?
No, you can't. The Supreme Court said you can't.
Getting rid of privatized prisons in the first place.
Johnny, the Supreme Court has said that money is speech. And if the private prison industry has money, they can use that speech to try to influence legislation and legislators and public opinion. And, you know, there is at the moment, given the doctrine of judicial review that, you know, was established in 1803 in the Marbury versus Madison case by the Supreme Court itself, this is not in the Constitution, but it's a doctrine of the Supreme Court. There is no higher authority in the United States as to what the law is and what the Constitution means than the Supreme Court. And so if they say that private prison corporations cannot be forbidden from lobbying, then they can't be forbidden from lobbying.
Yeah, on a side note, Tom,
yeah.
Did you mention earlier that we have 900,000 or 1 million, currently 1 million individuals employed in the private surveillance industry? Is that correct?
The number that was, I believe, in the Associated Press the day before yesterday was 800,000. And
800,000. So if 1% of Americans have a conscience and willing to act on that, that would be, what, like 8,000 individual whistleblowers?
Could be.
And we have less than a dozen.
Yeah.
So things are pretty bad.
Yeah. Well, just because somebody has a top secret or, you know, has a security clearance doesn't mean that they have, you know, access to the kind of information that would cause them to be so horrified that they would go out and blow the whistle on something. You know, it could be that janitors in some of these buildings have to have these kind of clearances just to be in the building. So it may not be as bad as it sounds, but I think you're right. What it does illustrate is it illustrates what kind of rare commitment and courage it takes for somebody like Edward Snowden and Bradley Manning to do what they did. Thanks a lot for the call, Johnny. I appreciate it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
John Kenneth Galbraith, the modern conservative, is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises, justification of selfishness. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And, you know, some of the smartest people are over in our chat room. I got to tell you, this is interesting conversation that went on some time back about Vigory. Anyway, back to back to the topics. Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, you wanted to talk about hypocrisy?
Yeah, well, privacy, we'll get to that. I object to the federal government having a list of the phone calls you make, as well as I object to the federal government having a list of the weapons you may choose to defend your family.
Okay.
I think they're similar. They're similar rights.
Do you object to the federal government having a list of the cars you own?
The federal government doesn't have a list of the cars I own, nor does the state.
You don't register your car with the state?
I have several cars that are not registered.
So you don't drive them?
I don't drive them. No, they're on my own private property.
Right. Okay.
And why would I register cars that I'm not driving on the street? Now, if I was taking weapons or if I was making, I don't know, how would I say the privacy rights? I think if I do things on the public streets, I should be public about it.
Yeah. Well, but to the best of my knowledge, Dwayne, you don't have much to worry about, because not only did the fairly reasonable effort to close the gun show loophole that the president and the Senate put forward and passed, not only did that not have a federal gun registry in it, it had a specific provision, the title of which was Making Gun Registries Illegal, that said that any person, any federal employee who attempts to create a federal gun registry can go to prison.
Well,
so,
I would agree with you.
You know, calm down.
Calm down. These large magazines should be illegal. I would even outlaw BB guns, toy guns. I'm not a gun advocate, but I see the privacy in the Fourth Amendment as being extremely important to all aspects of people's lives.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and I think that without privacy, you can't have political activism. I mean, people say, well, you know, there's no part of my life that I don't care what people know, blah, 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 you know. So over the next 5 or 10 years, the government compiles all kinds of information about you and all your Facebook and everything, actually, the stuff that's not even on Facebook. And, you know, whether you did something that you might be embarrassed or ashamed of, and or even not, whether you did something that you're very proud of. And then somebody decides, the government does something that you don't like, and you decide to become a political activist. And this could be something, you know, really draconian, or even something fairly small. You know, you could become an animal rights activist and say, you know, I'm against vivisection, or you could become whatever. It could be anything. You could become an advocate for the Second Amendment. And somebody in the government decides, okay, we're going to take down Dwayne. And so we're going to go back, we're going to look over his history, over his whole life, and we're going to find, you know, things that have happened to him and publicize them in ways that will make him look bad, and take things out of context and selectively print them, and things like that. It's like, that power, that danger horrifies me. And that has happened in other countries in the past, and I think it has the potential to happen here. Dwayne, thank you for the call. Yes, sir.
Can I suggest a solution?
Sure.
They tell me that an employer is entitled to know what's in your computer if you're using it at work.
Right.
I would suggest that the politicians are our employees, and I would therefore suggest that when a politician is receiving calls from lobbyists, that those calls should be public, and they should print those numbers available for us to know how much time each of our politicians spends on the phone talking to lobbyists.
Well, and the argument for that is that they are public employees, and so there has to be some, or should be some, transparency to what they do. And
thank you.
You know, yeah, I think that's a good subject for conversation. Dana in Marcine, Idaho. Hey, Dana, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. I just wonder when something by you, and it's just something I've been thinking about because of this whole NSA thing. And it seems to me, I know we're getting to come into an election, and I know that the right wing Republicans have been pretty discredited, but, you know, it's looking to me like there's maybe some of this media, and I'm not saying that the Snowden is not an innocent person in this, and he has a hero, but somehow it's leading to pull in liberals and as well as some of the libertarians that will be following or listening to anyone that's going to talk about these issues on a platform. And I just wondered what you thought about that.
I must have missed part of your question because I don't understand the essence of your question. Could you?
Okay. My essence is that with the NSA thing that's coming out, and what was the other issue? The Monsanto, there's the Monsanto thing. I'm noticing that there's a lot of liberals as well as libertarians that are joining in on these, you know, fired up about these issues. It appeals to them.
Right.
And those are issues that, like Rand Paul, some of the Tea Party members in the Congress would probably be trumpeting going into the election. And that if it isn't possibly somehow a way to siphon off and get, because there's going to be a big push to take, to overtake this, the Congress.
Right.
In the next election.
Right.
And this, they're always looking for ways to try and save those seats to build coalitions. And I just wondered if you thought this, there might be something to that.
To the possibility of Democrats forming coalitions with Libertarian Republicans to save Democratic seats or to simply have good public policy?
Or some of the independent liberal people who claim to be liberal, independent.
Sure. Here's the thing that we have to remember, vote. Dana. The most important vote that a member of Congress takes is that first vote on that first day where they vote for who's going to be the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the House of Representatives or who's going to be the leader of the Senate in the United States Senate. And in the Senate, it's always the Senate Majority Leader, I believe. I could be wrong on this, but I'm quite sure that whichever party is in the majority, they simply make that choice, and that person is referred to as the Majority Leader, and they set the schedule and run the show. But in the House of Representatives, the Speaker of the House is elected by the entire House of Representatives, and it is possible, and perhaps it's happened in history, I don't know. But it is possible that it could be somebody of the party that is not the majority. It's pretty unlikely. In fact, I'd say in the modern era, it's impossible. And so, therefore, the party affiliation of those members of the House of Representatives in particular really, really, truly matters, and the Senate as well, because they're picking who's going to be in charge, and that whoever's going to be in charge is going to define the agenda. So even if a Republican is good on a couple of issues, even if I like Rand Paul's position on drones, he's still going to say Republicans should be in charge. He's going to put the keys to the kingdom in Mitch McConnell's hands. Ron Paul, his father, when he was in the House of Representatives, put the keys to the engine in the hands of John Boehner. And so, you know, I think that our job has to be to, if we're concerned about the future of this country and in anything other than the fate of and future of millionaires and billionaires, our job has to be to get Democrats in those seats or independents like Bernie Sanders in those seats rather than partisan Republicans because of that. Am I making sense?
I agree.
Okay. Dana, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I agree. Just wanted to.
Yeah, no, I got your point. Boy, in a multi-party state, or if we had proportional representation, if we had instant runoff voting, something like that, it would make so much sense. And hopefully someday it will. Thank you for the call, Dana. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Noah.
Hold on, do I have you on speaker?
I don't know.
Hold on a sec.
No, it sounds good. What's up?
All right. 2 points, they're related. The whole, that famous military-industrial complex speech by President Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
I think we tend to forget just how complicity was in that. And it was a great speech, and it was terrific that he gave that speech, and we should do well to heed that. But he actually, under his administration, I think military spending, and I'm recalling this from memory, it may be a little off, but he almost doubled it. And besides that, he considered dropping atomic bombs on Korea and China. So it might be something to do with.
No, Eisenhower was
the
paragon.
The presidency corrupting you.
No, I here's This is, you know, I just mentioned this in passing before, Noah, but I really want to put an exclamation point at the end of it. We've got to stop salvationist thinking. We've got to stop thinking if only the right guy gets in, everything will be perfect. There's never going to be that right guy or girl. There's never going to be that right person, that right man or woman. We just have to stop the salvationist thinking and take responsibility for ourselves. It's movement politics that's going to drive movement activity that's going to drive politics, and we have to be part of those movements. Noah, thanks a lot for the call. And there's some really great movement political organizations out there. Check out ourfuture.org. Check out Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Check out movetoamend.org. And there's some really genuinely good grassroots organizations.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that, frankly, as activists, as progressives, I think, you know, yeah, you vote for the party closest to you, but you work for the movement you love. Defending America from the Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
Well, there was just a dramatic exchange in the Senate Appropriations Committee, and that's not a statement that you'll hear every day.
You mean just moments ago?
Yeah, just a few minutes ago, this is where National Security Agency Chief Keith Alexander is testifying, supposedly on the budget, but of course they're not really that interested in talking about budgets today. And what happened was somebody who I think you quite like, Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat of Oregon,
mm-hmm.
waved his Verizon phone from his seat.
Mm-hmm.
And asked Alexander to explain what authorized investigation gave you the grounds to seize information on his calls and those of millions of other Americans. And Alexander sort of sidestepped the question and said that was Department of Justice needed to answer that, but did say, I will work hard to do that, provide an explanation. And if I can't do that, I'll come back to you and tell you why. And Merkley said, how in a democracy can you have a debate if you can't talk about what the plain language of the law means?
And
Alexander said calls to declassify the legal justifications made sense so that the government could better explain its actions to the American public. The intent is to get the transparency there, he said.
Interesting. So Jeff Merkley is channeling the indignation of America very well, apparently.
With his Verizon phone.
Indeed.
Yeah.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that.
Also today, Edward Snowden is upping the ante on his leaks in talking to the South China Morning Post, mm-hmm. saying that U.S. intelligence agents have been hacking computer networks around the world for years, apparently targeting fat data pipes that push immense amounts of data around the Internet, saying among some 61,000 reported targets of the NSA, so Snowden said, are thousands of computers in China. And, of course, China has denied hacking the U.S., and the U.S. has accused China of massive hacks against the U.S.
Right. Doesn't that, though, I mean, you know, you said that this is a leak. Doesn't that kind of fall into the category of duh, you know, like, of
yes.
course we're doing
this is
that.
Sort of a dog bites man story.
Yeah, okay.
But it's interesting that he's talking about this, of course, because, you know, even though ostensibly Hong Kong has autonomy, of course it is under China, and it's something that would be of great interest to people in that country.
Mm-hmm.
I think also, if I analyze this, I think this also crosses a line for him, and I think this was a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Because this is where he went from being a whistleblower to being a leaker.
Yes.
Yeah.
And potentially a spy.
I agree. If he gave specific numbers about specific operations, I agree that that was a mistake.
I think it was a mistake. One thing is alerting Americans. This is not that.
Yeah.
Also, something interesting, President Obama, of course, is about to go to a G8 summit in Northern Ireland, also visiting Germany next week. Mm-hmm. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is ticked off. She's going to raise the issue with President Obama when he visits on Wednesday. Also, one official, Marcus Ferber, wrote in Der Spiegel that the U.S. is using American-style Stasi methods.
Merkel is upset with Obama about the NSA spying on Germany and German citizens?
Well, potentially.
Yes. Yeah.
Potentially, about what ramifications this has internationally, because, of course, the U.S. has been defending this by saying, well, we're only going after foreigners.
Right. And then the foreigners are going,
and then
what?
The president's meeting with the G8, a whole bunch of foreigners in Northern Ireland next week.
Right.
So there could be some awkward moments, I think.
I think, you know, things are getting interesting here.
Oh, I think they're going to get quite interesting, quite interesting. Also today, Representative Trent Franks, Republican of Arizona, sought to walk back a statement he made in a Judiciary Committee hearing when he said, as they were discussing a bill he's introducing that would ban abortions after 20 weeks, the incidence of rape resulting in pregnancies are very low.
Oh, geez. Another male Republican legislator offering his opinion about the needs or consequences or the situations of women who have been raped.
Yes.
Brilliant.
And Representative Jerry Nadler pointed out that the entire Judiciary Committee was made up of men, actually, or Republicans on the Judiciary Committee was made up of men. So now he's walked it back, saying pregnancies from rape that result in abortion after the 6 months, from the beginning of the 6 months, are very rare. This bill does not address unborn children in earlier gestation.
Pregnancies of all forms that result in an abortion after the 6th month are very rare.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's like, oh,
yes.
This is the most pathetic attempt to walk back a pathetic statement that I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, it's really odd. Anyway, the House Judiciary did sign off on this bill that would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. It passed committee by a 2012 vote and is headed for the House floor.
So this is what the Republicans are doing. The American people are saying to the Republican Party, you control the House of Representatives, which appropriates all money, period. It's where all spending begins, and we would like you to use that power to create jobs. And instead, the Republicans are spending millions of our taxpayer dollars to run that body to debate whether or not abortion should be illegal after the 20th week.
That's correct. And as Representative Jerry Nadler pointed out, it would ban these abortions even when a woman faces serious health risks and the possibility of death and makes no allowance for victims of rape or incest. They even rejected Nadler's amendment to provide a constitutionally required exception to provide the health or life of a woman and another to protect victims of rape or incest.
It's bizarre. This is absolutely bizarre. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. I wish they'd get back to jobs. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of the goat and the person you helped. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. And our old friend Lee Fong is with us, one of the finest investigative reporters working in the world, period, hands down. Reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund, the Nation Institute, and the author of his most recent book, The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and in this case, reporting for thenation.com. Lee, welcome back to the program.
Hey, nice to be with you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. I'm reading your piece here, how spy agency contractors have already abused their power. And there's a bunch of jaw droppers in here. One of them was your phrase, the venture capital arm of the CIA.
Yeah, that's right. In the late 90s, the CIA wanted to kind of leapfrog the bureaucracy and develop more technology companies that they could work with in the future, and they created a venture capital company called InQtel, and they've gone on to fund a lot of the private sector contractors that today make up the kind of intelligence agency industrial complex.
Now, I was reading yesterday that Booz Allen Hamilton is owned by the Carlyle Group. Is that the case?
Yeah, they own a majority stake in that company. That's correct.
And is the Carlyle Group entirely American-owned? I thought that there was at least one Saudi sheikh who was a major investor in it.
I don't have the current makeup of the Carlyle Group, but I believe it's an international company. There are executives all over the world that take part in leading that investment group.
Shouldn't that raise some questions in the minds of Americans?
Well, look, there are, as the Washington Post reported, over 500 companies involved in intelligence agency contracting. Some of these are small startups, but others are large companies with subsidiaries or ownership stakes all over the world. That's simply the nature of the industry, that it's so large and it's outsourced much of its work. I believe it's been reported that 70% of the intelligence agency budget has been outsourced to private industry.
Wow, 70%. So the title of your piece, How Spy Agency Contractors Have Already Abused Their Power. How have they already abused their power?
Well, in the story that a very few media outlets picked up, I believe you covered this in the Washington Post, 2 years ago, when I was at Think Progress, we uncovered that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and later Bank of America reached out to a set of spy agency contractors, Palantir, Barrico, and H.B. Gary Federal, to develop a plan to spy on and hack liberal activists, journalists, groups that were perceived as a threat to both the Chamber of Commerce and Bank of America. In particular, Bank of America was concerned that WikiLeaks would release private information about the bank, and so the private contractors that had been solicited to work for the bank developed a plan to smear Glenn Greenwald, who's, again, at the center of this kind of news storm. But 2 years ago, they set out to harm him, and on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce, they went out to, or they developed a plan to spy on and hack into the computers owned by the SEIU, the Center for American Progress, and a lot of other left-leaning groups.
Yeah, in fact, in your article, you quote a 2010 a memo, I guess, from H.B. Gary Federal's Aaron Barr. Correct me if I have any of this wrong. This is an email, actually. He says, I think we need to highlight people like Glenn Greenwald. Glenn was critical in the Amazon to OVH data center transition and helped WikiLeaks provide access to information during that transition. It is this level of support we need to attack. These are established professionals that have a liberal bent, but ultimately most of them, if pushed, will choose professional preservation over cause, such as the mentality of most business professionals. Without the support of people like Glenn Greenwald, WikiLeaks would fold. End of quote. Really? This guy, this is a law firm planning the destruction of an American reporter?
That's right. You know, and what's kind of incredibly revealing about that quote and the whole proposal that was connected to it was that these military contractors on behalf of these corporations said, you know, we don't have to worry about these normal traditional journalists. We have to worry about the journalists who are motivated by principle because they're the most dangerous. We can't just threaten, you know, their bottom line, because they're going to keep speaking truth to power. So it's folks like Glenn Greenwald, like Tom Hartman.
Like Lee Fong.
Folks who are, well, you know, the media outlets that are doing this because they care about social justice, about the public interest that can't be silenced, they're the most dangerous. And that those are the folks that they plan to really go after and harm.
And have they done so yet?
You know, we don't know. The whole reason we know about these proposals to hack Glenn Greenwald or, you know, the Center for American Progress was just out of a coincidence. You know, one of the military contractors involved bragged about what they were doing to the Financial Times. That provoked Anonymous to go after them and to hack into their emails and leak the plan. 75,000 emails were leaked onto the Pirate Bay. That's where I found them and reported on the story 2 years ago. Mm. But can you imagine how many other private contractors that have this type of technology? Like I said, there's 500 of them that currently work, at least 500 of them that currently work with intelligence agencies that could be selling this technology to any other domestic or foreign interests that, you know, would like to take someone down, that would like to use this technology to harm someone.
Amazing. So these, wow. You know, I've been saying for some time, we're talking with Lee Fong, and he's writing for The Nation right now, thenation.com, and his most recent book is The Machine, and if you don't have it, you should get it. It's a brilliant, brilliant book, a field guide to the resurgent right. Lee, my rant for the last 3 days, today's Wednesday, since Monday, has been this isn't about whether or not, you know, Edward Snowden is a hero or a goat. This isn't about, you know, whether the NSA ultimately even should be gathering up all of our phone numbers. That's something that Congress should have some oversight over, and arguably did. And I mean, I think they failed us, and the president failed us in signing the Patriot Act, the new revision of the Patriot Act, and FISA and all that kind of thing. But ultimately, this is about the fact that private for-profit corporations are now in the business of gathering intelligence, and therefore, because the Supreme Court has said that money is speech, and that corporations have rights under the Constitution to lobby Congress and to influence public opinion, their efforts are going to be to grow their industry, to lobby for more money, for more national security. And we're going to get a national security state whether we want it or not, just because it's profitable. Am I making sense?
That makes perfect sense, and I hope that you're talking about this, but I hope that becomes the national conversation, because this is the issue. Part of the reason that we've seen such an explosion in the size of the surveillance state is not just because of the post 9/11 mindset that is a very important factor, but we have kind of this self-perpetuating problem when we have these huge companies like CSC, like Northrop Grumman, like Lockheed Martin, like any of these folks. Not only do they receive these contracts, they then go and hire lobbyists, they fund trade associations, they fund dark money groups to then pressure Congress to give them more contracts.
And they hire PR firms to get the stories out about how scary the terrorists are.
No, that's right.
I mean, more Americans die slipping in the bathtub every year than are killed by terrorists. And yet we're frantic. I'm ranting. This is... But we're out of time anyway. But it's Lee Fong, the brilliant piece in The Nation. Go to thenation.com to read it. The title is How Spy Agency Contractors Have Already Abused Their Power. Lee, good luck.
Great to talk to you, Tom. Take care.
Thanks so much for being with us. And stay safe, my friend. Stay safe. You're doing God's work. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Seriously, if you haven't picked up Lee's book, The Machine, it's a good read. It's an amazing book. We'll be back. It's Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman Program does not, however, leave you stiff thinking. Don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. Chris in Kings Park, New York. Hey, Chris, what's up? Chris, listening on WWRL? Chris is not there. Let's see if Steve in Issaquah, Washington is on the line. Steve?
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hey.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure. What's up?
I wanted to, you said earlier the goal of a corporation was to make a profit, and I wanted to maybe help clarify that for you and say the goal should be to be profitable, and it has to consider the social bottom line and the environmental bottom line, as well as the financial one. And if people would think about it again in that way and figure in the externalities, maybe we could vote with investments and help turn things around a little.
Right. Well, here's the timeline of this. The modern corporation, you know, corporations in their modern form, were created in roughly the 1850s, 1860s. Prior to that, corporations were very, very rare prior to the Civil War. They were principally created by communities to do things like the Erie Canal, digging the Erie Canal. There was a corporation created to do that by several states and some investors, and the Erie Canal Corporation. And it had a limited lifetime. Once that canal was dug, then, you know, it became the property of those states, and that was the end of that. So that was the beginning. And then as the railroads rose up, and then, you know, we moved into the industrial era. And prior to that, you know, we'd been mostly an agricultural country, and most farms were not incorporated. They were run as businesses, but they were not, there was no corporate form there. But then as the Andrew Carnegies and the John Rockefellers and, you know, we, the industrial giants came along in the late 19th century, the late 1800s, a more modern corporate form took place. And so the states had, because a corporation has to be chartered in a state, every state had corporate charter laws and still does to this day. And up until, and at that point in time, after the Civil War and before the 1890s, every single state in the United States had required a corporation to have as the first sentence in their articles of incorporation a statement of purpose which was binding upon them legally, which said that the primary purpose of this corporation is to conduct business in a way that will enhance the quality of life in this state or will inure some benefit to the citizens of the state. There were variations on that language from state to state, but it was always basically our first obligation is to be a good citizen. And then our second up, and then the second purpose of this corporation is to, and you had to specify a purpose. That purpose could be to build a railroad. It could be to build railroad cars. It could be to drill for oil. It could be to make, you know, stick figures, whatever. And then the third thing is the lifespan of the corporation had to be defined. And each state defined how what the maximum lifespan was. And again, up until the 1890s, there was no state that allowed a corporation to exist for longer than 40 years. Most states were 40 or 30 years. There were a couple of states that were 20 years. But none of them were over 40 years. And the thinking behind that was we don't want to allow somebody to use the corporate form as a way to avoid probate, as a way to avoid estate taxes, as a way to amass fortunes forever. We don't want to have a landed gentry in the United States. We don't want to repeat the mistakes of the United Kingdom that we separated from because of those kinds of things. So then in the late 1880s and early 1890s, Ohio, I forget what the year was, but it was in that neighborhood. Ohio said to John Rockefeller, who at that time was colluding with the railroads, that he had cut a deal with the major railroad that was going through Ohio and Pennsylvania, that they would carry his kerosene at a much lower price than anybody else's. And so he was putting all of his small competitors out of business and then buying them up. And he had created this thing called the Standard Oil Trust out of all of these smaller companies. And some of them, many of them, hostile takeovers or bought them out of bankruptcy. And the state of Ohio said, this is illegal what you're doing. You know, it's a violation of the charter laws. You're not operating to the benefit of the citizens of Ohio. And we're going to put you in jail or shut you down. And so John Rockefeller said, okay, Ohio won't let me do this in Ohio anymore. Who will? Who will change their laws? Who will let a corporation live forever? Who will let a corporation do whatever it wants? And this big competition ensued between Connecticut, Delaware, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island in particular over who would have, it was called the chartermongering era, and it was throughout the late 1880s through the early 1890s, where state after state would loosen their charter laws and knock off one thing or another thing until finally the winner of the competition, the state that got John Rockefeller's business was New Jersey. He moved his headquarters to New Jersey. But the state that ended up with the most lax corporate laws was the state of Delaware, which simply says that you can have a one-sentence article of incorporation that simply says the purpose of this corporation is to do anything that is legal in the state of Delaware. And that's why more than half of all the corporations on the New York Stock Exchange right now are Delaware-chartered corporations. Now, at that point, corporations started living forever. And then the profit motive came along. And in the 1920s, when Henry Ford decided that he was going to pay his workers, you know, $5 a day instead of a dollar a day, Horace Dodge, who owned a competing company, sued him. And it went before the Michigan Supreme Court. And what Dodge said was that Ford shouldn't be paying his workers that much money because a corporation should be required to show a profit as their first purpose. And the Michigan Supreme Court agreed with Dodge's logic and said, yes, the purpose of a corporation. So this has never been litigated before the Supreme Court, to the best of my knowledge, but that Michigan precedent seems to be the precedent that everybody always quotes. Said, yes, a corporation must, number one, show a profit, but number two, Henry Ford can continue paying his employees more. We're going to give the case to Ford because Ford has come before us and demonstrated that by paying his employees more, his employees can buy his cars, which will increase his profits, which is how it worked out. So that's the history of it, Steve. And you know, I would love to go back to pre-charter monger era when thousands of corporations every year got the corporate death sentence and were literally put out of business and their assets were sold off and their stockholders got screwed. But, you know, it's going to take a lot to get us there. Steve, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Steve, sorry to do the brain dump like that. I'm not sure if I answered your question. I hope I did. We'll be right back. The good, the bad, and the very, very zifasorinly ugly, the good. Joe Biden. According to a pool report published today in Talking Points Memo, the vice president proclaimed Al Gore as the winner of the 2000 presidential election while speaking at a fundraiser for Massachusetts Senate nominee Ed Markey. He reportedly said, "This man," speaking of Al Gore, "this man was elected president of the United States. He was elected president of the United States of America. But for the good of the nation, when the bad decision, in my view, was made, he did the right thing for the nation." End quote. Supreme Court's theft of the 2000 election was a shameful moment in our nation's history. We need more politicians like Vice President Biden to speak up so we can prevent something like that from ever happening again. The bad, or maybe just the bizarre, Glenn Beck. During his radio program yesterday, the right-wing talk show host claimed that the Occupy Wall Street movement is a sign that the world is starting to worship the ancient pagan gods Moloch and Baal. Seriously, take a look.
I've said for a while, when we were going through Occupy Wall Street, and you saw them smearing feces on the police cars, when we saw that they took feces and smeared them all over the altars in the churches in England. And Rabbi Lappin, I wrote to him and I said, this is Baal, isn't it? But the ancient rituals are here. And whether we know it or not, that's exactly what our society and our world is doing right now. Worshipping Moloch and Baal.
Apparently this is the theme of Glenn's new book. Rumor has it that those who pre-order copies get not one, but two free tinfoil hats. And the very, very ugly Harry Houck. The former NYPD detective appeared on Fox News yesterday to discuss the murder trial of George Zimmerman. He said this about the prosecution's strategy.
He's injecting something into their minds. What was going on? Like, this is a little kid with candy walking down the street. Listen, Trayvon Martin would be alive today, okay, if he didn't, all right, have a street attitude.
Right. Then let there be no doubt about it. Houck's comments are racist to the core. The sad thing is they're probably just the tip of the iceberg of what we'll be hearing on Fox so-called news in the coming weeks. And that is just very, very ugly. That's incredible. That's just incredible. By the way, I had said earlier that Bernie Sanders had said that Ed Snowden was a hero. Bernie did not say that. I had heard that, and not from Bernie. I had heard it from another source, and I thought it to be true, but it is not. So, and Bernie has not condemned him either. He has not. We'll find out on Friday what Bernie has to say about it. But I shouldn't be. In fact, I shouldn't even be quoting Glenn Beck if Glenn Beck doesn't come on my program. So I'm saying this, well, unless it's a public speech. But just for the record, Brian in Chicago. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to Sirius.
Hey, Bob. Yeah, I was like actually just looking through all the details on this Snowden NSA deal, and as a technology analyst, I can tell you that it doesn't really add up. His access to the actual data, unless he was like a architect of this thing and actually doing database administration, wouldn't have given him access directly to the data. And subsequently, there is no real other way for the NSA to do this. I mean, you have to collect all the data to go back and look at some of it. Otherwise, we have to go to Google and Yahoo and all these places and say, spend millions and millions of dollars to develop long-term archiving solutions that just, you know, we can't force these corporations to spend this money to do this for us.
Well, your comments are predicated on the assumption that we need to have all this data to be able to go through at some point retrospectively. The law says that you cannot in violate the privacy of a person's papers, possessions, home, whatever, life, without somebody swearing before a judge under oath that they have probable cause to believe that a crime has been or is being committed. And that's why the foreign the FISA courts, the foreign what is it, intelligence surveillance act courts, were created so that there would be some third branch of government, some judicial branch, having the ability to say, yes, you may violate that person's Fourth Amendment rights. So, well, you know, independent of Snowden, whatever he may or may not have known or been able to do, I would argue with the underlying premise of your comment.
Well, I think that, you know, in the earlier era, we would have gone to the phone company and asked them the paper out of a filing cabinet, you know, to verify what time or place a phone call was made.
Right.
But today, you can't do that. I mean, somebody has to collect the data for us to actually go get the information, you know?
Yeah. What I'm saying is that the ability to track down and prosecute somebody for any crime, I mean, the main crime that is talked about is the crime of terrorism, but frankly, there are, you know, some pretty horrible crimes that are, you know, this guy who had these three women and trapped in his house for 10 years, whatever. The ability to track down and prosecute somebody using good old-fashioned police methods is sometimes going to fail if there is not, you know, this massive database of information available. But having that massive database of information available at all times on all of us is such a violation of Fourth Amendment privacy rights that the occasional failure of prosecution, even of terrorists, is a price I'm willing to pay.
What do you think about data mining? So is it a violation for a corporation like a Walmart or Target to track the fact that your card came into a store and build a profile on you?
No, it's not.
It's not. Because it's a private enterprise.
Because Walmart does not have the power to come to your home with a gun and drag you out.
Right.
I mean, this is a really important distinction, and it's the one,
right.
You know, it's like a broken clock is right twice a day. Every now and then the libertarians get something right. And the one thing that they will point out, now I think they use it wrong, but they point it out accurately, is that the power of government is unique from any other power. It is literally the power of life or death. It's the power of freedom or imprisonment. And when an agency that is entrusted with that power has to be very, very carefully regulated by or constrained by the people over whom it has that power. So the ability of Walmart to track me, you know, to make money, you know, I can care or not care. I can be offended or not offended. I can choose to behave in a way that makes it easier or harder to track me. But at the end of the day, right. It's whether or not Walmart's going to make money. It's not whether or not I'm going to go to jail. But with our government, there is a power that is associated with government that, you know, liberals have to own up to this too, right? And conservatives have been yelling about this for years. There is a power associated with government that is so great, and I think liberals are seeing this in the case of Bradley Manning, for example, that is so great that it has to be constrained. And so I, you know, like I said, I can't stop Walmart or Amazon.com. I'm offended by the fact, you know, I talked about this on the air with her permission, with Louise's permission, that when my wife was first diagnosed with breast cancer a little over a year ago. And, you know, thank God she's on the other side of that now. But when she was first diagnosed, she went, you know, Googling breast cancer like crazy. And then she goes to the TV studio to work, you know, in a cubicle with a whole bunch of people, and pulls up the New York Times page, and here's an ad for wigs for breast cancer victims, or, you know, stuff like that. You know, it's like that's offensive, but that's a whole different thing from taking you off and putting you in jail. Am I making sense? Okay.
Yeah, I guess the distinction they're trying to make is that they're only collecting email that's more likely to be internationally bound. The argument
that was originally put forward by the Bush administration and by administrations prior to that actually was that the Fourth Amendment protections do not apply to people who are not U.S. citizens. And even that I think is arguable, because although in this modern world I think practically it's not arguable, but it. You know, if you wanted to get into a hair splitting, the Fourth Amendment says persons. It doesn't say citizens. And in fact, right, nowhere in the Constitution does it say citizens. It always says persons. Now, you can argue that the reason for that was because there were persons in the United States who were citizens of the United States who the founders did not want to give rights to, those being slaves and women. And so the language of the Constitution is imperfect, shall we say, as a consequence of that, which gets back to that original sin of slavery, you know, at the founding of our republic, and the original sin of the disenfranchisement of women. But that's really splitting hairs. But I think that they were trying to make that distinction. Yes, we could spy on foreigners. And as Victoria Jones pointed out, now you've got Angela Merkel going, oh, really? And Obama's on his way over to Germany. It's going to be a very entertaining conversation. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, Brian, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening there on Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. The news of the day. Yeah, the Republicans are hard at work. They've been debating abortion. An entirely male Republican group has been debating abortion all day. Finally had a vote to pass it out of this bill out of committee. That's what they're doing with your time and money.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Jobs bills in the House of Representatives? No. Can't have that. No. Sequester? Undo the damage? No, can't have that. Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you don't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you, and which raises the question, why isn't the corporate media talking about the privatization? I mean, here, Lee Fong was on our program. His name is spelled F-A-N-G, by the way. It's pronounced Fong like it was an O, but it's F-A-N-G if you're looking for his new book, The Machine, which I highly recommend. But, you know, here's Lee Fong pointing out in this article in The Nation that 70%, an estimated 70% of our national security budget has been outsourced to these private for-profit corporations that are just skimming money off the top. Their CEOs are making big salaries. Everybody's making big salaries. It's like, you know, hogs at the trough. And I admit, I am not a big consumer of media. I haven't watched MSNBC in several days. I haven't watched Fox. Actually, I haven't watched any television in several days. But I do keep up with what's going on. I mean, you know, it's you read about what's said and things. But from everything that I'm hearing and everything that all the feedback I'm getting, nobody in any of the corporate media is talking about this. I don't know why not. Or if they are, I congratulate them. Alan in Gatesville, Texas. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Tom, I was just interested and wondered why that retired general, I believe, Clapper, the NSA, is not being cited for contempt of Congress regarding the answer to Senator Wyden's.
It's a good question. Because Clapper is working for a Democratic president, and Ron Wyden is a Democrat. I would guess, and that sounds rather cynical, but I just, you know, typically you don't see parties go after their own, you know, you don't see Republicans in the legislature go after Republican presidents. You don't see Democrats in the legislature go after Democratic presidents. Clapper, by the way, is not a former general. He was a former executive at Booz Allen Hamilton.
Oh, okay.
Which is even worse.
He was a lieutenant, lieutenant general retired.
Well, he might be. He may well be. But actually,
you know,
okay. Yeah.
First the military and then to Booz Hamilton.
Okay. So if that was his path, that makes sense. But the one part that I know is the Booz Allen part. But you know, maybe he will be cited for contempt of Congress. I rather doubt it. And you know, color me cynical. But Alan, thanks for the call. I think he should be. Chris in Kings Park, New York, listening to WWRL. Hey Chris, what's up?
Hey, I called before and I lost you. So thanks for getting to me, Tom.
Sure.
You made a comment before about the people getting out of prison and all that stuff, and they need treatment. And I
said about half of them. About half of the people in prison right now, according to the statistics published by the Bureau of Prisons, are either mentally ill or are addicted, which is arguably a mental illness, an illness anyway, and need treatment.
I was going to say that it's probably more than that in my experience and through, you know, whatever organizations, you know, I've dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than that, and these people need more of an opportunity to come back into society, not to stay on the fringes and be looked at as, you know, because they're the victims of these corporations as well. I mean,
yep.
The pharmaceutical companies are pumping pills out like they're making money, literally, like they're printing money, and people are falling victim to it, and I think it's something that's overlooked.
Yep.
And the stigma surrounding it don't give these people the same fair chance that they might very well deserve.
Yeah, I totally with you, and very well said, Chris. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for attending to the issue. Todd in Bryant, Indiana. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Oh, hanging out, watching you, listening to you guys. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay, well, you were talking about the supremacy of the Supreme Court, and it got me thinking of the fifth article of the Constitution, where 3/4 of the states can override all 3 branches of the federal government.
Right.
I was wondering if you could read that short article, and then just give some thoughts on it. I'm going to let you go, and I'll listen. Thank you.
Okay,
bye.
Thank you. Article 5. No, that's Amendment 5. Let me get to Article 5. Here we go. The Congress, whenever 2/3 of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or on the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states or by conventions in 3/4 thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress, provided that no amendment may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses of the ninth section of the first article. In other words, you can't, before 1808, you can't end slavery, and that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. You can't, by amendment, reduce the number of senators. So those are the two limitations. But basically it says that you can amend the Constitution either through Congress or through the state legislatures.
Yeah.
And we've got to get David Cobb on to talk about this, because from movetoamend.org. Because there is a conversation going on right now, and a good and vigorous one, about creating a, quote, constitutional convention, not one where, now, I always read this article of the Constitution to mean you'd actually have a physical convention where people would sit down and say, okay, what are we going to do? But my understanding is that there's actually a mechanism where you can say, okay, here's the amendment. Corporations are not people anymore. Money is not speech anymore. Here's the amendment, and our state is going to have a, quote, convention for the purposes of ratifying that amendment, and then put that forward. And if you can get 3/4 of the states or 2/3 of the states to vote for that, and then to say, yes, this is a constitutional convention, and then 3/4 of the states to say, yes, we salute that flag, if this is my understanding of it, then that is how that's one way to amend the Constitution without even having Congress meet. It can be done entirely at the state level. Coming up tomorrow, We'll have the latest on whistleblower and apparently now leaker Edward Snowden. And Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire, is going to weigh in. Plus an update on the Zimmerman trial with our legal expert Debbie Hines of Legal Speaks. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Check out ourfuture.org. Check out pdamerica.org. Go to free-don.com. Get out there, get active, occupy something, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.